Well, thank you for that good word, Ross, how God works through all of our infirmities. And guess what? If you're a human being, you will go through infirmities. It's guaranteed. If that hasn't happened to you yet, just wait. It will happen. So, and hallelujah, because God always works things together for good for those who love Him and are called according to His purpose. And I've actually got a story about that in the book that is coming out on September 1, Always Be Ready, and basically tell a story of how I got diagnosed with the widowmaker artery being completely blocked, and they said, you're not going home, we're doing surgery on you tonight. And it's like, hey, what's going on here? I'm a runner, what's happening here? So, but they showed me the results, and yeah, it was completely blocked, and they did surgery. But I was in the hospital for 4 days and probably had the most wonderful opportunities to reach out that you could possibly imagine. I mean, for example, I came out of surgery and the doctor did the surgery in an hour and a half, which is normally 4.5 hours. He did it really fast. So I was fortunate that they had a heart transplant surgeon just happened to be available and he was right there. So we won't have to put you in the heart-lung machine. We don't want to mess with your brain. I found out I was a scientist, so I can do this quick. We want to put you in a heart-lung machine. And what was interesting is I came out of surgery, and the room was packed with all these doctors and nurses. And they wanted an outreach event. So I wound up giving a lecture as I was coming out of anesthesia. And the doctor said, hey, you're on morphine, you're going to feel good. This is the time for us to ask you questions. So, and Kathy walked in and said, how come there's 40 people in here? And they said, well, you can visit after we're done with him. So, and then what was interesting was that over those 4 days, I got visited by 5 chaplains. And it's like, you know, it's rare for people to get more, even one chaplain visit. I wound up getting 5. And I was told by the 5th chaplain that visited me, this has never happened before. Well, I tell a story, you'll see it in Always Be Ready, how the first 4 chaplains, I quickly figured out they're really not Christian. They really haven't submitted their life to the creator of the universe. And so I just asked them a question. I said, you know, well, what's stopping you from making this commitment? All 4 of them said, science is what's stopping us. And I said, well, would you like to talk to a scientist who actually believes the Bible is the inerrant word of God? And they said, well, you know, do they even exist? There's one guy insisted that I couldn't possibly find a scientist who held that belief. And I was sharing a room. The guy next to me says, just ask him who he is. So I wound up talking. I wound up having a couple of hours with each of those 4 chaplains. And it's like they had never heard that there was a scientific case for taking the Bible as the inspired, inerrant word of God. And he just kept firing questions. And they said, you know, where can I go to read stuff? So I was able to recommend some books that they could read. Chaplain number 5 on the last day comes in. And I recognized him because he was actually at a retreat that I did for chaplains up in Oregon. He was one of the participants there. And so I was sharing with him about these. He says, I know these 4 chaplains. And he says, I'm going to follow up on every one of those 4. So then I got released. And it was several months later, they came back with another test on my arteries. And they said that artery that was totally blocked is now 100% clear. And they figured it had nothing to do with cholesterol. It was a result of this plane trip I took from Sydney to Los Angeles. 17-hour flight. I was in economy in a middle seat. And I wasn't really able to get up. And they said, well, we think that's what caused the clot. It says the clot's gone now. And so they did say, if I ever compete athletically, I need to let people know because I got 5 arteries feeding my heart, not just 4, like the rest of the population. And believe it or not, I notice it when I go up mountains. I mean, you notice that, right? Yeah. Yeah, it's like gives you a little extra boost. So, you know, all things work together for good. If it wasn't for that, you know, trauma, I wouldn't have had an extra artery or those opportunities to share with all those nurses and doctors and those four chaplains that thought science was a barrier. And, you know, the whole point is, every one of us living here in America, you're going to have a hospital visit once in a while. But it's just like what Bark is experiencing. There's opportunities there. When one of God's people faces a trauma, everybody's curious just how we're going to be able to handle it. And it's a great opportunity. And I'm convinced God will give you several opportunities. Look forward to it. It's exciting. As both Paul and Peter point out, if you're a serious follower of Jesus Christ, you're actually going to suffer on the average more than the rest of the population. But God is going to use that extra suffering to do amazing things. You're going to rejoice in what happens because you actually be able to see it. Now, a big disclaimer. I got to see this fairly quickly, literally within a few months. Often it takes a decade. So again, you see this in Peter and Paul's writings. Be patient, for the all things that work together for good. The good might take a while, but it will come. So just be patient, it will happen. Hey, great piece of good news. The computer that was causing me problems and couldn't show any visuals for the past several weeks, there was a visitor here in the class. He's an expert on these laptops. And he says, Hugh, you got both a hardware problem and a software problem. It's not going to be fixed. Would it be all right if I buy you a new computer? So it's thanks to him I have this. And it's amazing. It's way better than anything I've had before. So. And I've been wanting to show you visuals for the last 4 weeks, and today we actually have visuals. And incidentally, they do go up on the paradoxes.org website, and that's being worked on. And so if you're not aware of it, we have a lot of participants in this class who participate through live streaming. And we're actually working some things out to boost that audience. And a whole lot of people download so everything that's here, it gets recorded in both audio and video. And so this is something you can share with people. Hey, if you heard something that you like, and incidentally, it's not just me, it's the questions and the responses. And so one request I've gotten on my Facebook and Twitter pages, please encourage people when they ask questions to speak in a loud enough voice that it gets picked up on the recording. So that's just a request, but I just want you to know the audience for this class is a lot bigger than what you see here. And there are times when we get as many as 1,200 downloads a week. And incidentally, our biggest audience are not Americans. Our biggest audience are people in mainland China. So but I wanted to share with you a discovery before we finish up our little thing in the book of Isaiah about God creating the universe. But before I do that, let me get out of here. Exit. Come on. I'm still learning how this works. Here we go. Let me just go back a bit. Okay. No? Wrong direction. I thought you'd enjoy this. I got this card from a friend. And you know, I've been a pastor now for 43 years, so I thought you'd enjoy this card. Policeman's there and says, Reverend, have you been drinking? And the Reverend says, just water, officer. And here's the fold out. Then why do I smell wine? Good Lord, he's done it again. So, yeah. And, you know, I hear that during, my parents tell me this, that during Prohibition, the only place where you could actually get liquor was in church. It was permitted for communion. And so what happened during Prohibition, you know those little tiny communion cups we had? Well, it wasn't grape juice, it was real wine, and it wasn't these little tiny cups. The cups kept getting bigger and bigger and bigger. as Prohibition got longer and longer. And towards the end of Prohibition, the churches were packed. And instead of having communion once a month, communion was every week. So, and if there was multiple services, people would come back for all the services. So, but my parents also tell a story of how during Prohibition, the Canadians made a lot of money, because what they did is they set up bars right on the border where all the chairs were in the United States, but the bar was in Canada. And when they got raided, everybody just put their drinks down in Canada. It was literally right on that line. And incidentally, you can still see that line this day. If you go to British Columbia, they've got what's called Highway Zero. Highway Zero is in Canada, but the shoulder is in the United States. It's literally right on the border. And you know, there's nothing there, there's no fence or anything. It's just kind of a forest, but you're on Highway Zero. But I heard that during Prohibition, there was bars all along that highway. So, okay, what I wanted to share with you, about a year ago in the class, we talked about Earth and the Milankovitch cycles. Anybody remember what Milankovitch cycles are? Okay, what's a Milankovitch cycle?
Ice age cycles.
Okay, but that
very complicated set of different things going on with the time on Earth and weather patterns, but mainly around about orbital cycles, which I don't understand.
Okay, Milankovitch was a Serbian physicist. And he was trying to understand, they were just learning about the Ice Age cycle. And so it was emerging like 100 years ago. Yeah, there really is a cycle where we get an Ice Age and an interglacial, and it seems to be periodic. Now we got ice core drills that show us that it's extremely periodic, not just over the past 800,000 years, but over the past 2.59 million years. And that it's unique to our time. But Milankovitch was one who came up with an answer as what causes this Ice Age cycle. And basically pointed out that there's a slight variation in the tilt of Earth's rotation axis. Right now it's 23.5 degrees, but it actually reaches a maximum of 24 degrees and a minimum of about 22.5 degrees. And what he was able to point out is that when the tilt goes over to 24 degrees, that warms the planet up a little bit. And when it tilts back to 22.5, it cools the planet down. And if you look at this tilt, it has a period of 41,000 years. Now, there's other periods too. I mean, it's more complicated than that. But the dominant cycle is a 41,000-year period. And so what that would do is that every 41,000 years, it would warm the planet up and then cool the planet. And actually, from 2.59 million years ago until 800,000 years ago, our Ice Age cycle indeed had a period of 41,000 years. Now, when I say 41,000, it's 41,000 plus or minus about 5,000. And that's because there's actually more than one periodicity in the tilt of this rotation axis. But notice, the tilt is very tiny. But even though it's that tiny, it does impact the long-term climate of planet Earth. The other thing that Milankovitch pointed out is that there's a tiny variation in the shape of Earth's orbit about the sun. So, if you actually, you see, those are the two extremes. One extreme is where Earth is orbiting the sun in almost a perfect circle. It's like within a perfect circle to 0.05%. But the other extreme, it shifts away by about 5%. And so there's this change. Now this is more complex. There's a 2 million year cycle, a 400,000 year cycle, and a 100,000 year cycle, and I think there might be other cycles, but the dominant one is 100,000 years. And so, you know, the shape of Earth's orbit will go from almost perfectly circular to slightly elliptical. And so for the past 800,000 years, it's that variation that's been driving the ice age cycle. So every 100,000 years, we get an ice age. And what happens is when you got it circular, that cools the planet. And when it becomes more elliptical, that warms the planet. And a lot of it is because of the fact that we have most of the continents in the northern hemisphere. Continents tend to be cooler than the oceans in the wintertime. Now, what is it that generates these cycles? Okay, if I go back to this tilt, what generates that is the fact that you've got the major planets shifting the axis a little bit, but Earth has the most stable rotation axis tilt than any planet in our solar system. Yes, I need to be pointing over here. Okay, thank you. For the benefit of the virtual people, I need to be pointing, and incidentally, this one's actually a little better image than that one over there. So yeah, thank you for getting me over here. The other planets, their rotation axis tilt is much more dramatic. I'll show you in a minute. But what keeps our rotation axis as stable as it is the fact that we have a small rocky planet being orbited by a giant single moon that's not too far away. I mean, the moon's only 238,000 miles away. Incidentally, I found that they got a new unit for describing how many miles is on your car, because now the cars are so well built, they basically say, how many lunars do you have on your car? Lunar, if you got one lunar, that means you've got 238,000 miles on the odometer. So, but because the moon is so close to our planet and so massive, that actually stabilizes the tilt of our rotation axis. Now, in the case of the shape of the orbit, the primary factor that drives the changes in the shape is the gravitational pull from Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And by the way, it's in that order. Jupiter has the biggest impact, Saturn next, Uranus next, and Neptune next. Now, as you'll see in my book, Improbable Planet, over here, there's been a lot of research done on these Milankovitch cycles, understanding these subtle changes in the orbit of the Earth and the rotation axis tilt and how that affects the global mean climate, how it drives the ice age cycle. What's brand new, literally published just a couple of weeks ago, a team of astronomers has decided to investigate the impact of Milankovitch cycles on planets outside the solar system. And the first thing they note is that the Earth-Moon system is an extreme anomaly in our Milky Way galaxy, in the sense that we got this small planet orbited by a gigantic moon, and we recognize that our moon formed like no other moon we know. It formed as a result of basically two planets merging with one another, and the merger event led to the formation of the moon. And so what they point out in their paper, this has to be extremely rare event, and maybe it's possible that the Earth is the only body that has this anomaly of a giant moon orbiting not far away and stabilizing the tilt of rotation axis. So they said, we may need to redefine habitability of these extrasolar planets, taking into account the fact that the rotation axis tilt variation is going to be much greater than we see here with the Earth-Moon system. And then also, they note that when you look at this Earth and the gas giants, I'll show you a slide in a minute, but the extrasolar planets, extrasolar planetary systems we're discovering, you have two scenarios. One, the gas giants orbit their stars a lot closer than our gas giants do, and that's the majority position. You know, most extrasolar planetary systems, that's what you see. You see gas giant planets orbiting, say, where Mars orbits or where Venus orbits or even where Mercury orbits, and a bunch even interior to Mercury. And in that case, you're going to get enormous variations in the shape of the orbit of rocky planets, because after all, the gas giant planets are so very close to rocky planets that would be at the right distance from the star where liquid water would be possible on a surface. Okay, the other population we see are where the gas giants are very, very far away, much farther away than Jupiter, Saturn, Uranus, and Neptune. And now we have the understanding of why that happens. A lot of papers have been published making the point that what's typical in extrasolar planetary systems is that the gas giant planets migrate towards their star. And then there are situations where they don't migrate at all. What's unique about our gas giants, they migrated in towards our star, they stopped and then reversed and then stopped again. And so they happen to be at this unique distance, something we don't see in any other planetary system. We only see it in the solar system. And it's because it had this unique history where gas giants began to migrate inwards, stop migrating, change direction, reverse, and then instead of leaving the solar system, they actually stopped again. If you want the details, it's an improbable planet. It actually requires our solar system being born with 10 planets and then winding up with just 8. So yeah, we need to be teaching our children in the classes that we had 10 planets. And they've actually got a name for the 9th planet. They haven't yet named the 10th planet. But there was a time we had 5 gas giants and we had 5 terrestrial planets. Now we've got 4 of each. And that's part of the reason why Earth doesn't get much change. They say, well, wouldn't it be good if we had very distant gas giants? Because then they wouldn't be impacting the shape of the orbit at all. The problem there is they'd be so distant, there would be no protection from asteroid and comet collisions. And we'd be beat up so badly by them. I mean, you know, we do get a few collisions. I think I showed some images here in class a little while ago of a crater event you could see in Arizona. But you know, that wouldn't be nice if that were happening every day. Or if you had asteroids that were, say, 5 kilometers across smashing into the Earth, you get something that big, you wind up exterminating over 75% of the species of life on planet Earth, and guess who's the first species to disappear? We would be. We're first on the block. So you don't want the gas giant planets to be so far away there's no protection, but you don't want them so close that it begins to generate big changes in the shape of the orbit. Now, this slide shows you the climate change you get from changes in the tilt of our rotation axis and changes in the shape of the orbit. And for the past 400,000 years, what's been dominating the changes has been the shape of the orbit. But yeah, if you go back previous to 800,000 years, what has been dominating it was the change in the tilt. Incidentally, this is really good for human civilization because we were living at a time when the changes were being dominated by the tilt of the rotation axis. The warm interglacials would be lasting less than 2,000 years. And it's hard to build sophisticated civilization from a Stone Age culture to what we have today of all you got is 2,000 years. I mean, literally, it took us 13,000 years to get where we are today. So, but as you, this by the way is temperature, and zero basically is where we are today, and it's in degrees centigrade, so multiply approximately by 2 to get degrees Fahrenheit. But it shows you that every 100,000 years, the temperature jumps up to a maximum, then it drops down, and then jumps back up to a maximum of roughly 100,000 years later. And I say roughly, again, it's about plus or minus 15,000 years. And that's because we're looking at multiple cycles, not just one cycle. But what's typical when you have these different cycles working is that it gives you extreme climate instability. And so this explains why, for example, humans living 30,000 years ago weren't able to develop sophisticated civilization. The global mean temperature was just jumping up and down way too radically. And the reason why we have civilization is that for the first time in the entire Ice Age cycle, all the cycles came together to give us a period of extreme climate stability. That's the exception. It's not the norm. This is the norm. That's been the case for the past 2.5 million years. What we see for the past 9,000 years is an exception that's unlikely to ever be repeated again. Now, I got a series of three articles. Two of them actually have been released. The third one's coming out tomorrow. Basically talking about how we've had this period of extreme climate stability and how it must come to an end, because these cycles have been sinking together, and human activity has also been a factor in giving us this period of stability. If we hadn't domesticated cows and rice, we would be in an ice age right now. The ice age is basically 5,000 years overdue. But it's thanks to us humans domesticating rice and domesticating cows and basically growing a whole lot of rice and having lots and lots of cows. So all those burgers, they're actually helping stabilize the climate. So it's a very complex interaction between human activity and the coming to sync of these seven different cycles and the tilt of our rotation axis and the change in the shape of our orbit has given us this period. And the article I've got coming out tomorrow, I basically explain what are our options for delaying the onset of this extreme climate instability. What can we do to stop it from happening? And what is the prognosis that we might be able to sustain this period of climate stability, say, for another 1,000 years? I do point out that it's unrealistic that we can sustain it for 2,000 years. But 1,000 years, maybe even 1,400 years, is within reason. If we're not careful, we could be entering a period of extreme climate stability in as little as 100 years. Yes, Ross.
Would you please explain how rice and cows
Okay, what about rice and cows? Because probably a lot of you have never grown rice, never been in a rice paddy, and maybe it's been a while since you've been around cows. But if you hang around cows, what you notice is they emit a lot of gas, way more than any of us ever emit by a huge margin. Now, most of the gas that they release is methane. And the other part is carbon dioxide. Both of those gases are greenhouse gases. And the other thing that has happened is that when humans domesticated rice, they quickly figured out that if you flood the field, the rice actually grows taller and you get a greater productivity from the rice. So most rice in the world is grown in flooded fields. But when you do that, the rice releases a lot of methane to the atmosphere. Now, methane is a far more powerful greenhouse gas than carbon dioxide. Fortunately, there's not a lot of it in the atmosphere. However, it's thanks to humans domesticating cows and domesticating rice that the quantity of methane in our atmosphere has almost doubled over the last 6,000, 7,000 years. And it's because of that doubling of methane in the atmosphere, instead of us dropping into an ice age, we've actually been able to stabilize the climate. And I'm sure all of you have heard about the global warming controversy that's going on. Yeah. The point there is, well, we got a lot more cows today than we had 50 years ago. It's like, we're not the only ones eating hamburgers. Everybody's eating hamburgers now. And so there's a lot more cows. And so that means a lot more of this stuff is going in the atmosphere. And likewise, just our human activity is pumping a lot more carbon dioxide. And the concern is, instead of stabilizing the climate, we're going to warm it. And if we warm it, let me go back here. If we warm it even just 2 degrees centigrade above where we are right now, if that's what we see in the ice age cycle, every time that has happened, we get an ice age. Now, If you read the article that I released last Monday, I explain why global warming always brings on an ice age. It always brings on an ice age because when you warm the planet 2 or 3 degrees centigrade more than it is today, you basically melt away the polar ice cap. And when you melt away the polar ice cap, instead of sunlight being reflected off of the Arctic, sunlight gets absorbed by the open ocean water. And when that happens, you get a lot more water vapor in the atmosphere, and that excess water vapor will fall as increased snow over Siberia and Canada. The reason we don't have an ice age right now, because Siberia and Canada, believe me, are plenty cold enough to get an accumulation of ice. I mean, when I was doing radio astronomy in Northern Ontario, our American astronomers would say, gee, you guys only got one season here. And we say, oh, no, no, we have 4 seasons just like you do in the United States, only they're not all of equal length. We have 10.5 months of winter, and we literally got snow every month except July. So we have 10.5 months of winter. We get 2 weeks of black flies, 2 weeks of mosquitoes, 2 weeks of horse flies, and then it's winter again. And I don't know why the Americans always came up during our summers. Like, that's the worst time, because, you know, you get all, and incidentally, the lake that the telescope was on, because you're such a high latitude, it absorbs a lot of sunlight. The water temperature was above 90 degrees in the summertime, just because the sun was up all the time. And even in the Yukon, they got lakes that get to that temperature, just because the sun's always up. However, in the wintertime, minus 45 below, and it just stays like that for months on end, but it makes for wonderful observations. All the water comes out of the atmosphere, and literally the quality of my observations were 400% better than they were in the summertime. So I always apply for the coldest months of all to do my observing, which was a little bit traumatic because it was a 1 mile walk between where you sleep and where the telescope is. So you better have one of these parkas that actually warms the air before it gets to your face, or you're going to be in trouble. But that was fun too. Believe it or not, when I would walk that mile, a pack of wolves would accompany me. They were well fed because we had a cook with an unlimited food budget. So they didn't have to hunt, they just went to the food pile. And so here were these well-fed wolves, and they wouldn't come right beside me. They'd be about 30 feet away, but they would literally, I got an escort back and forth. Kind of interesting. So, yes?
We have an online guest who's asking what the source of the graphs are.
Okay, these graphs come from ice cores. And they're basically looking at the oxygen 18 in the different layers of the ice. One layer is 1 year. And so each layer will have a little different oxygen 18 quantity in it. But oxygen 18 is a very good proxy for the temperature. And for example, in this slide, it actually shows several different ice cores. So the purple line is a different ice core than the blue line. You do see a temperature difference. What you notice is both of them show the same temperature going up and down. Now, this has been done in Antarctica, Greenland, and the Alps. And basically, all of them reveal that the entire temperature of the world goes up and down according to what you see on this graph. So yeah, it's temperature on the y-axis and years on the x-axis.
So
yes.
They publish them?
Well, you'll see the credits in Improbable Planet. I actually credit, but they're basically produced by teams who are researching these deep core drills. And these deep core drills are always in places where the ice never melts in the wintertime. So we have good evidence that we're actually looking at annual layers. Matter of fact, we know these must be annual layers because you can see the dust signatures of volcanic eruptions that we know have, because they actually happen in recorded history. So, and now they're actually doing a drill where they're gonna get more than 1 million years of a temperature record. But the best one we have now is 800,000. And there was another question along here. Yes.
How far does the ice age go down? Like when you're talking about ice age, how far does it come on the Earth?
How far does it come? I got a slide where I can show you. It literally came right down to Southern California, the last one. And what's been interesting is that, let me see if I can exit this and get you down there. Here we go. So this slide, the green stuff is ice that's over 1,000 feet thick. Actually more than 1,000 meters thick. So we're talking 3,000 feet of ice. And you notice that 3,000 feet of ice went all the way down to Manhattan. All of Ohio was covered. Good chunks of Kentucky were covered. And this only shows the regions of the world that had 1,000 meters of ice or more. Much more of the planet was covered with, say, 100 feet of ice. So, for example, Yosemite Valley was carved by ice retreating from the last ice age. Yosemite Valley is relatively young. That cut that you see there, that's just happened as a result of retreating ice 18,000 years ago. But you notice all of Canada is covered with thousands of feet of ice.
How about Puerto Rico? Was that ever covered with ice?
Puerto Rico is not covered with ice. However, in terms of, this basically shows you the extent in summer. Winter ice in the oceans got down as far south as San Diego. So San Diego was not an ice-free port during the last ice age. Neither was San Pedro. But the southern limit was San Diego. We're talking Baja, California, no ice. So, but this map simply shows you the permanent, really thick ice. But notice you got virtually all of Siberia covered, all of Canada covered, and a good chunk of the United States gets covered with all that ice. But also notice that in the middle of Asia, you've got a really big pile of ice. All of Tibet's covered, and a whole lot more beyond that. And incidentally, this has the biggest impact on cooling the planet. The ice that's over the Tibetan Plateau and the Himalayas. Why? Because it's so close to the equator. Because it's so close to the equator, it reflects sunlight much more efficiently than ice reflecting off of Antarctica. So yeah, if we warm the planet up too much, it's going to be bad news for all my friends in Canada. Yes?
With regards to this, all this ice age stuff, I'm reflecting on the fact that was Rana and reasons to believe they date Homo sapiens like a maximum of 200,000 years ago, right? So if the cycle repeats plus or minus X number of years, every 100,000 years, say mankind is Homo sapiens is 200,000 years old. We are 200,000 years old. Did the ice age reset us completely?
Well, or just to be careful about these dates, Doug, we've got indisputed dates that humans have been around for about 40,000 years. Beyond that, that's based on carbon-14 dates. 36,000 to 40,000 years, we got data that can't be disputed that says that we humans were around at that time. Anything earlier than that, we don't have good radiometric tools. So in terms of referring to those dates for the origin of humanity, what we have cited in the second edition of Who is Adam? Is that the best scientific date we have for the origin of humanity is 150,000 years ago, plus or minus 150,000 years. So just want to make that clear. We don't have an accurate date. Moreover, when people basically publish these finds on, hey, we found sophisticated art that dates 80,000 years ago, what they're really looking at is a date that's between 25,000 and 80,000 years, but often what you see is they quote the oldest edge of the error bar rather than giving you the actual range of possible dates. So that's just a caution.
Something you said this morning kind of triggered my curiosity when you were saying, like, it takes like 12,000 years for modern society to develop or civilization.
Okay, where that comes from?
Yeah.
Okay, if you look at this graph here, about 12,000 years ago, the temperature began to rise. No longer did you have climate instability. You had a situation where you had a predictable rising temperature. Now, where farmers can predict the climate in the next several years, they can plan accordingly. If you're in this environment, you really can't plan. You have no idea what's going to happen. It could be colder next year or warmer next year by many degrees. And it makes it difficult to engage in any large-scale agriculture. We do have evidence that people living 35,000 years ago were planting crops, harvesting grains, roasting those grains, grinding the grains, and making bakery products. So they were doing very sophisticated stuff, but it was all on a very small scale. Because with the temperature jumping up and down like this, it simply wasn't possible to specialize on one crop on a large scale. But once they could predict the future temperature, they could do that. What's interesting, the moment that the future climate became predictable, you see what's called the Neolithic Revolution. 12,000 years ago is when you see towns being built, when humans begin to specialize. When one town, for example, the people only grow wheat. Another town, all they do is raise goats. And another town, all they do is make pottery products, and they begin to trade with one another. All that was possible because they could predict what the climate was going to be like. And then that started 12,000 years ago. 9,000 years ago, the temperature actually stabilized. Instead of going steadily up, it actually plateaued. And with a plateaued temperature that changes very little, now you can gauge in really large-scale stuff. So that's when you had people planting, say, 4 square miles of wheat. And then they began to breed the wheat to make it more productive. And they began to do the same thing with their animals.
Where would you date language and writing starting?
Well, writing, again, here's part of the problem. If you're trying to do that here, it's going to be in such a small scale, it's going to be difficult to discover. It was only 2 years ago that they were able to establish that humans living 35,000 years ago were engaging in sophisticated agriculture, just on a very small scale. It's possible we'll find a discovery that they were even engaged in metallurgy. So far, the earliest date we got for metallurgy is about 4,000 to 5,000 years ago. But it's possible it was around earlier, just in such a small scale we can't detect it. And likewise, that would apply to, you know, I mean, we do have evidence that humans were engaging in sophisticated art. There are caves in France and Spain that date as far back as 33,000 years ago. And incidentally, the pictures you see in your textbooks don't do it justice. The cave in France that dates to 17,000 years ago, it's like an art gallery. I mean, the cavern is bigger than this room, and literally extends for hundreds of feet, and you have these giant murals on the ceiling. I mean, it's just like the Sistine Chapel. There's stuff on the ceiling, stuff on the walls, and a very sophisticated nature. But inside a cave, again, they could count on the fact that things aren't going to get disturbed much. If you go deep into a cave, the temperature is relatively constant, no matter what's going on outside. It's not going to rain there, so. But these artists had to be using scaffolding, because we're not just talking doing this. They had to actually build scaffolding to get up high enough to do kind of what Michelangelo did, so he could actually paint on the ceiling. So it basically shows you humans living tens of thousands of years ago were just as smart as we are, just as motivated to technologically advance civilization as we are, but they had the limitation of extreme climate instability. That's what held them back. And the moment you don't have that, you get a burst of technology. And you get a second burst when things begin to stabilize in terms of its temperature. Yes?
Where was The Garden of Eden, actually.
Well, we know the Garden of Eden had to be at least this far back, because that's when we get the earliest indisputable evidence from carbon 14 dating, that we got humans engaging in sophisticated art and sophisticated agricultural activity. It could be earlier. I mean, I actually argue that you probably get a more accurate date from the Bible for God creating Adam and Eve than you do from the science. Because the Bible tells us that the Garden of Eden was at a time when four known rivers come together at one location. Today, that location is about 250 feet below sea level. Now, for it to be above sea level, you have to be living during an ice age. So sometime during the last ice age, which basically means sometime between 15,000 years ago and 130,000 years ago, we got God creating Adam and Eve. That's still not very accurate, but it's a lot more accurate than our scientific dates. So, but at least as far back as 35,000. So, yes, you had a question?
Can you go back to the graph that shows that goes back 400,000?
Yeah.
The very top of those spikes where
yes.
Global warming and then it falls off and cools, how quick does that happen?
Well, as you can see from the graph here, it happens quite quickly. And the model that basically points out if you melt the polar ice cap, that doubles the precipitation over Canada and Siberia. Both Canada and Siberia today are deserts. Most of Canada gets only 10 inches of precipitation a year. And because it gets so little precipitation, ice can't build up. There's not enough snowfall, in spite of how cold it is, for that snow. So for example, that observatory I was talking about, come July, all that snow is gone. And so it takes another 10 months for the snow to build up, and then all the snow melts away. If you were to double the precipitation, the snow would not disappear. It would accumulate year after year, and where it accumulates year after year, that snow transforms into ice. That ice reflects sunlight, which means you're going to get even more ice forming, and then the ice sheet begins to move south at a rapid rate. And you know, what this graph shows you is that once the planet gets warm enough to melt the polar ice cap, very rapidly you see this buildup of ice. The other thing we know from looking at previous ice cores, looking at these ice cores, is that the first sign of an oncoming ice age is the accumulation of snow in western Siberia, followed by an accumulation of snow in Labrador. If you see both of those things, you know an ice age is coming. What about right now? We're not seeing any buildup of snow in Labrador. And there's disputable evidence of whether we're seeing it in western Siberia. Some people think, yes, we are. Some people are saying, well, no, not really. It's just a blip where we've had a few cold winters. But if you see it both in Labrador and western Siberia, then you better get some more warm clothes and think about moving south. So, yes.
And earlier read about any comments of increased temperature causing increased cloud cover, which itself being white would cause increased reflectivity.
Well, there are a number of ways, because that's one of the big mysteries is, if I go back to this graph, why didn't the temperature go up to the normal spike? Something happened that stopped the temperature from jumping up. Because, you know, this was a time when we were actually beginning to domesticate cows and we were domesticating rice. That should have pushed the temperature in combination with the natural cycle up to a point. It didn't happen. Something else occurred that cooled the planet, counterbalancing what the Milankovitch cycles and human activity should have produced. And there's been a number of speculations. Maybe there was some big volcanic eruptions that put dust into the atmosphere and reflected sunlight away. Whenever you get big volcanic eruptions, you get cooling. Maybe there were fires, and that caused the cooling. Maybe there was a lot of carbon dioxide trapped into clathrites that could have explained why we had cooling. I mean, there's a lot of ideas out there, but something happened. And hey, if you read the literature, this is a complicated discipline.
Have you heard any comments about cloud reflectivity?
Oh yeah, but I mean, there's different ideas on that too. How clouds could actually warm the planet or cooling the planet in terms of what kind of clouds you're talking about and where the clouds are and where the precipitation's taking place. But there is a general consensus. If you dump more precipitation on Canada and Siberia, you're going to get an ice age. And so melting the polar ice cap is not a good thing. So, okay. Now, one more question, then I want to jump ahead to this big research I want to talk to you about that was published 2 weeks ago.
I want to know, what do you think James Hansen is, big problem with global warming and climate change that, has become a big controversy. How does this fit with everything you're saying, or is he a little off?
Well, I mean, we got the inventor of the internet jumping in on this problem, too. You know, The Inconvenient Truth, and he's got a sequel out.
Didn't want to mention it.
Okay. Well, I've actually got a blog where I critique, Al Gore's new book on Inconvenient Truth. I want to compliment him. His second book is much more balanced than his first book. I'm basically saying, hey, it's a step in the right direction, but we need to go a lot farther in that direction. And people like Al Gore recognize his initial suggestion, which was we can bring the temperature of the planet down to a level we're not going to bring on an ice age if we make draconian economic sacrifices. And basically was arguing all the peoples of the world need to agree that we're going to get by with a lot less wealth and technology. Now, when he's recognized in his second book, that's a hard sell.
Yeah.
I mean, I've tried that on my sons. I said, what do you think about the idea of your generation getting by on half the wealth that you have right now and letting go of all these little technological toys that you have? And their comment was, we would rather see the end of civilization than give up all of our toys and give up our wealth and give up our freedom. Now, that's typical of how humans typically think. I mean, I think the problem with a lot of people in this global warming thing is they're making a spiritual mistake. They think all of us human beings are basically good. And we realize what this inconvenient truth is, we'll all do the right thing. Now, the Christian worldview says that we're all sinners, and by nature, we're selfish. And so people are typically going to do what's in their own best interest, not what's in the best interest of the whole population. And so, we in the United States could make the big economic sacrifice, but what's going to guarantee the other 250 nations of the world will follow our suit? And all you need is a few nations saying, we're going to take advantage of your sacrifice and we're going to keep our wealth and technology. That spoils it for everybody. Al Gore, to his credit, has recognized in his second book that's a huge problem. And so he's actually suggesting there's some things we can do which will not damage our economy and yet would help ameliorate the climate situation we're in. Now, where I think he needs to go one step farther, there are solutions where it's not just no economic sacrifice, there's actually an economic benefit. Now, that's an easy sell, okay? Here's some way we can not warm the planet up as much as we're doing, and it's going to put more money in your pocket and give you more technology, okay? Now, as a selfish human being, I say, that's good for me. I think I'm going to go along with that. I'm going to have my technology and wealth enhanced, and I'm going to have more freedom, I'm in. Count me in. And so we need to find solutions that have both an economic payoff and an ethical payoff. And I argued in my book, Hidden Treasures in the Book of Job, that God in advance has provided us with those kinds of solutions. One of the evidences we have for the supernatural design of planet Earth is the fact that in advance God has provided us with solutions that are optimally economic and at the same time optimally ethical. And so I gave several examples, and there are more. Now, people are starting to think that way. They're basically realizing, you know, it's going to be very difficult to convince people to make draconian economic sacrifices. And so, you know, one of Al Gore's ideas in his first book was, let's ban all automobile traffic in the United States. Okay, everybody's going to ride bicycles to work. Okay.
What about Hansen, though? Does Hansen square with you?
I don't know too much about Hansen. I mean,
that's where Gore came from, was Hansen.
Yeah. Well, again,
he was a scientist.
Yeah, okay. There are scientists on both sides of the fence, but I think what's becoming quite clear in the scientific literature, you can't doubt the correlation between greenhouse gases and temperature rise and fall. However, what's being debated is a time constant. Okay, we pump more carbon dioxide in the atmosphere. How long does it take before that begins to impact the global mean temperature? Is it 10 years? Is it 100 years? Is it 150 years? Are there other gases that can make a bigger factor? And what about, so for example, there's several papers that have been published that said what's melting the polar ice cap is not so much greenhouse gases, it's carbon soot. So coal burning in certain parts of the world actually winds up falling on the Arctic ice. Because one of the things they've noticed is the polar ice cap is melting a whole lot faster than what our greenhouse gas models would predict. Way faster. And so they're saying there's got to be something else that's melting the polar ice cap. And yeah, there's been several papers saying soot could probably be a bigger factor. And just to put things in perspective, since 1980, half of the polar ice cap has melted away. And so in summertime, you can take a freighter or an oil tanker across Alaska, northern Canada, and over to Europe. It's completely ice-free during a few weeks in summer. That's never happened before in human history. It's there right now. So.
You got 5 minutes.
I got 5 minutes, is that all? Okay. Gee, I don't know whether we're going to get to Isaiah or not. This is the big discovery that was published in the scientific literature, and I got an article coming out on this, not tomorrow, but next Monday, basically saying what astronomers have discovered is that in terms of rotation axis tilt, what we see on Mars is the norm. Mars doesn't have a gigantic moon to stabilize its rotation axis tilt. No other planet in our solar system does, and this is likely going to be the case for planets outside of our solar system. And in that case, you're going to have gigantic changes in the temperature taking place because of the huge changes in the rotation axis tilt. And the other thing they notice is that instead of having a slight variation in the shape of the orbit, you're going to get something like this, or even more extreme. And we've been able to measure this with planets outside the solar system. The small planets that are about the size of the Earth, indeed, this is what they experience. If they've got gas giants, as I said, some of them, the gas giants are far away, in which case you don't get this disturbance, but neither do you get the possibility of life, because they don't have the protection of nearby gas giants. But this is the predominant situation. And so what they've done in the paper, they said, okay, given that the Milankovitch cycles are more extreme for planets outside of our solar system that happen to be in the water habitable zone than they are on Earth, what are the consequences? Oh, and I got this little graph too. This doesn't show up too well. Maybe if we turn the lights off, you'll be able to see this. Especially, you know, there we go. Okay, in the middle is our solar system, basically showing you the orbits of gas giant planets relative to the central star. I should have put a star there. I didn't have time to do that this morning. What's typical is this situation, where the gas giants orbit close. And when they orbit close, you get big changes in the shape of the orbit for the small rocky planets. And the other situation, much less common, is this one, where the gas giant planets orbit far away and don't disturb the shape of the orbit, but neither do they provide any protection. This situation is unique to our solar system. Okay, bottom line of this research paper is they said, okay, given that we're going to get a bigger rotation axis tilt in planets outside of our solar system, and incidentally, this is true of all the other planets in our solar system except for Earth, and given that we're going to have bigger changes in the shape of the orbit, what are the consequences? Bottom line was, they said, you get one of these two scenarios. Either the planet generates these Milankovitch cycles where the temperature, global mean temperature, goes up and down by such a radical amount that the planet permanently becomes an ice ball or permanently has no water on it at all. You get one extreme or the other, and depending on what kind of Milankovitch cycles you get, as long as they're bigger than the ones we have here on planet Earth, they said this is inevitable. In fact, the paper concludes, we here on planet Earth barely escape this scenario, where we wind up, so if we just had Milankovitch cycles even slightly bigger than what we have right now, we'd be doomed to become either a permanent ice ball or a planet like Venus, where there's no liquid water available anywhere on the planet. In which case, they conclude the paper by saying, this big number of habitable planets that we've accumulated, it needs to be redone. We need to take into account these Milankovitch cycles, and basically, they didn't say this in the paper, but as I read the paper, I said, you know, the real conclusion to draw, we may be the only planet that's got Milankovitch cycles small enough with gas giants close enough to protect us from deadly collisions where we could actually have sophisticated life on the planet. So this is a huge change in the thinking of astronomers about the habitability of planets outside the solar system. I think what excites me most, it actually shows you just how much design on planet Earth we've been ignoring. Our planet is way more fine-tuned, exquisitely fine-tuned, than we've ever recognized before. We need these exquisite Milankovitch cycles, exquisitely fine-tuned Milankovitch cycles for our civilization to be possible. Because I've explained here in the class and the book Improbable Planet, if we don't have an ice age cycle, we can't grow enough food to feed billions of human beings. We need the melting of ice left over from the last ice age to be able to irrigate the great agricultural plains and grow the food we do. And also, thanks to the ice age cycle, our great agricultural plains get re-fertilized every 100,000 years. So today, we're living off of the fertilizer deposited on the great agricultural plains 100,000 years ago, and we're living off the water melting from great glaciers left over to provide us what we need to feed all those people.
You're out of time here.
I'm out of time, I know. But thank you. And next week, we'll get to Isaiah, all right? I promise, next week, no scientific discoveries. But hey, I'm just so excited to be able to show you visuals again. This is wonderful. And that actually shows you the status of the Arctic ice cap right now, which is about half the size it was back in 1980. Let me bow in prayer. Father in heaven, we thank you for the age in which we live, this 21st century, where literally every week we see scientists making discoveries that reveal your supernatural handiwork in a way we've never seen before. Thank you, Lord, for just how dramatically that we see this principle, that the more we learn about nature, the more evidence we see for your supernatural handiwork and design. Father, I pray that the scientists that are making these discoveries would actually consider the implications of what they discovered, not just physically, but spiritually, upon themselves and upon others. And I pray, Father, for our staff here at Reasons to Believe, help us to be able to accurately report on what has been discovered and to help people understand both the physical and spiritual implications. And Father, may many come to know you as Lord and Savior as a result. Lord, we look forward to this remaining time you've given us of climate stability, to be able to use that to fulfill the Great Commission, to take the good news of salvation to all the people, groups of the world. And Lord, we know you've got a much better creation and plan for us. Help us, Lord, those of us who know you as Lord and Savior, to speed that outcome. In Jesus' name, amen. Yeah.